Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. There seems to be some sort of shadow effect on my presentation, so I apologize for that. I don't know quite why there's a shadow effect on the presentation, but hopefully when it gets going, we'll be able to read it. So today, I want to deal with a question that is deceptive in its simplicity. And it's deceptive because when we dig down and look at the issues underpinning it, it turns out that it's actually extremely difficult to find a coherent and plausible answer. And that question is, why punish international crimes? And, okay, hold on, bear with me. I think I need to... No. Let me just, I think. Okay. Sorry, it's at the end of the presentation. It's going back to the beginning. It's all good. All right. Yeah. Okay, we're good. So, why punish international crimes? So first of all, a few definitions. By international crimes, I'm referring to the core or pure international crimes, encompassing at a minimum crimes against humanity, genocide, serious war crimes, and the crime of aggression. Crimes that in general are manifestations of collective criminality, and which are distinguished by the fact that their criminal character originates in international rather than domestic law. By punishment, I've taken a definition from the recent book by Larry May and Shannon Fife being on our panel today, so you should all definitely check out this book. Punishment entails the intentional incapacitation or infliction of pain by an authoritative institution on one who has been deemed liable to such treatment. So far, so simple. Now, what is the importance of asking this question? Why do we need to justify punishment for international crimes? Well, here I take a definition from Kent Greenwald in his famous 1983 paper on punishment. He states that since punishment involves pain or deprivation that people wish to avoid, its intentional imposition by the state requires justification. Hopefully we can agree on this. So how do we justify punishment for international crimes? Well, the traditional starting point for international criminal scholars and international criminal practitioners is to go to the major theories, the dominant theories that were put forward in domestic criminal law to justify domestic punishment. The theories of retributivism and deterrence, both in its specific and general form. Now, I don't want to go into these in detail today because, well, frankly, there's not enough time. And if you want to see my thoughts on how these apply on the international level, you can read the paper. Retributivism, the idea that punishment is morally justified because criminals deserve to be punished, the idea of just deserts. And deterrence, the idea that punishment is morally justified as a means for preventing future criminal behavior, either of the defendant on trial or of society in general. These theories have been applied to international crimes, but they've met two overarching challenges. First of all, they've been accompanied by any weaknesses inherent to them at the domestic level. And secondly, the assumptions underpinning these theories have not always been appropriate when applied to the context in which international crimes take place. Now, I've teased you by putting the two extra slides on retributivism and deterrence on this overarching slide, but I'm not going to go into those. You can read the paper. Instead, what I want to focus on is the set of theories, the cluster of theories known as expressivism. Because these are really the most, I would say, the most popular theories nowadays amongst international criminal scholars, and so they're the most interesting ones to examine. David Lubin stated that expressive theories rest on the premise that actions can express attitudes and send messages quite apart from their consequences. And in the punishment sphere, expressivism is normally rooted in the work of Joel Feinberg, who stated that punishment, in short, has a symbolic significance largely missing from other kinds of penalties. And it's this idea of the symbolic significance of punishment which really marks out expressivist theory. Now, what my paper does, what I hope it contributes to the field, is it makes two important distinctions. The first distinction is that we need to distinguish the expressive character of punishment from expressive justifications of punishment. It is entirely plausible that I or another scholar could say that we could agree that punishment has a symbolic significance, but then not go further and say that that symbolic significance justifies punishment. But the theories that I'm looking at today, of course, are ones that say not only does punishment have a symbolic significance, but that symbolic significance justifies its imposition for international crimes. That's the first distinction to bear in mind. The second distinction is that although in the international criminal literature it's common to just talk of expressivism, in fact, if we return to the domestic literature, there are two separate strands of expressivist theory. There is intrinsic expressivism, which is in essence a sort of subset of retributive theory, and there's extrinsic expressivism, which is in essence a subset of utilitarian theory. So let's take a closer look. Intrinsic expressivism. This is the idea that punishment as an expression of moral condemnation is intrinsically right and proper. The expressive character of punishment here is used to inform the retributive notion of desert. And again, there is not just one conception of intrinsic expressivism. There are actually at least two dominant theories that have been put forward at the domestic level and which may be discussed in relation to international crimes. So first we have what I call victim-based intrinsic expressivism. This is the theory of Jean Hampton in the late 1980s, where she stated that punishment is justified because it vindicates the value of the victim denied by the wrongdoer's action. Okay, so let's explain that a little bit further. Hampton argues that when a wrongdoer commits a crime, they give the appearance of elevating their own value above that of the victim. Hampton refers to this as diminishment. And what punishment does, on Hampton's account, is it equalizes the value. It brings that appearance of a higher value for the wrongdoer back into equalization with the value of the victim. Punishment, its symbolic significance, vindicates the value of the victim denied by the wrongdoer's action. Okay? Now, what are the challenges of applying this theory to international crimes? Or not just international crimes, actually, what are the challenges of this theory in general? Well, the first challenge is actually punishment may not be seen as the symbolic significance of punishment, perhaps is not one of equalizing the value of the victim and the wrongdoer. Some have argued that actually punishment itself is a form of diminishment. Punishment puts the wrongdoer at a lower value than that of the victim, and so therefore is morally problematic on this account. A second challenge is Hampton doesn't really give us a way of distinguishing why it is that punishment is justified on her account. It's equally likely that a more effective means of vindicating the value of the victim could be by providing redress or compensation, some form of reparation. Hampton doesn't tell us why punishment is particularly suited to this role of vindicating the value of the victim. Oh my goodness. That was definitely not supposed to happen. Sorry. Hold on. Okay, let's leave it there. And I'll just explain. Okay, so the second theory you can see, but you won't be able to read, the second intrinsic theory is the communicative theory. And this is really the work of Anthony Duff, who is an exceptional philosopher of criminal punishment. And Duff says that punishment is a species of secular penance that is able to communicate the censure that offenders deserve. On Duff's account, through the burden of hard treatment, it is hoped that an offender will come to repent his crime, to reform him or herself, and thus reconcile him or herself with those he or she has wronged. So this is the idea that punishment has a communicative value, that through punishment we can communicate to the offender the censure that they deserve. And we can hope through this, although it doesn't have to happen, but we hope through this that there is some form of reform, repentance, reconciliation that follows. So what are the challenges of this communicative account? There are two. The first is the challenge, especially at the international level, of identifying a relevant political community that is shared between the punishing institution and the offender for such communication to be effective. Duff's account relies on this notion that there is a shared community between the punitive institution and the offender. But at the international level, often we either have a post-conflict society which has been shattered and lacks a political community in the aftermath, or it's just rebuilding that political community, or we have an international community which can't really, in all plausible terms, be described as a political community. Duff accepts this, but then says, actually, maybe it's okay if we just have a shared moral community, a shared moral community between the punishing institution and the offender. And we can find this shared moral community on the basis of conceptions such as our shared humanity, our shared life forms together. But even if we overcome this problem of a shared community, there's still the implausibility of punishment persuading wrongdoers to repent their crimes, as Duff's account tells us it is hoped. And this implausibility comes precisely from that lack of political community. International crimes are often political in nature. David Lubin tells us, for example, that crimes against humanity is politics gone cancerous. Our political institutions are turned against us, they deny our individuality, they deny our sociability. They're underpinned by political ideologies, political programs. In this scenario, it is more likely that a defendant will see punishment as a continuation of political struggle, will not accept the punishing institution's political program that it is trying to put in place. And therefore, this is a challenge in the international context that punishment has to meet as a form of communication. Okay, I dare to push the button to see what happens, but okay, it seems to have corrected itself. That's fantastic. So that's intrinsic expressivism. Now we move to extrinsic expressivism. This is where punishment is morally justified in light of the beneficial consequences that flow from its expressive character. Okay? So it's a form of utilitarian theory, but it's based on the symbolic character of punishment. And again, there are two strands to this. First, there's the moral education theory. And here I quote one of my favorite scholars, Mark Drumble, who states that punishment internalizes and even reinforces social norms among the public, and thereby, from the expressivist perspective, proactively promotes law-abiding behavior. So on this account, punishment is a norm solidifier. Punishment plants the moral flag, produces moral propaganda, helps internalize norms that the international community would like to promote in populations, and thereby, with those norms, the populations are, on this theory, less likely to commit crimes in the future. The population is morally educated by punishment. But on the international level, there are a number of challenges with this theory as well. First of all, there's the sociological legitimacy challenge. Often punishment is implemented by international institutions that are remote from the populations that they are targeting with their message. They're remote in terms of language, geography, culture. There's numerous divides between the institution and the local community. And so the challenge here is whether the message which is sent by the punishing institution, whether it reaches the population, whether it reaches the population via biased avenues, or even whether it reaches the population and the population simply rejects it as illegitimate. Then there's the challenge of punishment being able to create this moral consensus in societies that have been ripped apart by conflict. In a post-conflict environment, the divisions often remain. How can we expect punishment, the mere act of punishment, to generate this moral consensus? It seems unrealistic. And the final challenge is empirical, and that's that even if we could say that punishment internalizes norms, and it internalizes these norms that the international community wishes to promote, it's not always the case that that internalization process is a sufficient guard against future crimes being committed. Oh, it's started again. So what I tried to do is I quote an ICRC study, which essentially says that they did a study in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And in that study, they found that actually the fighters had internalized the norms of the Geneva Conventions. They knew about those norms. The reason crimes were committed was that the circumstances which the individuals faced in that exact moment were simply overriding those norms. So even if you have internalization of norms, it's not necessarily a guard against greater social circumstances overriding your ability to follow them. So that's another challenge of this theory. The second extrinsic expressivist theory is that of Geoffrey Murphy in the domestic context, and that's the gratifying victim hatred theory. On this theory, crime causes feelings of hatred in victims, and punishment is a means of quelling those feelings of hatred so that they do not continue a cycle of vengeance. So we need punishment to prevent cycles of vengeance. Now, this theory has a number of problems as well. First of all, it suffers from a social psychological challenge. And this is as follows. So, okay, if we accept that victims feel hatred, feelings of hatred from having crimes, international crimes done to them, the imposition of punishment, while even if we could prove that it quells those feelings of hatred, it may antagonize those groups that are, in terms of identity, associated with the perpetrator being punished. So in post-conflict societies, what you often have is societies continue to be divided along the lines of the conflict. And when you implement punishment against a member of a group, then the members of that group in the population also feel that punishment as an attack on their identity. And so actually by imposing punishment in a situation, even if you quell the feelings of hatred in the victims, you may antagonize feelings within members of the wider who associate with the perpetrator. And the second challenge to this theory is that it's quite subjective, the idea of victims feeling hatred and therefore needing punishment in response to it. You could quite plausibly say, okay, they may have these feelings of hatred, but that does not justify responding to them with the imposition of hard treatment. Victims themselves may not even want that, especially in the pluralistic societies that are dealt with in international criminal situations. So my paper goes through each of these expressivist theories and raises challenges. Now, I'm not saying these challenges are insurmountable. I'm merely raising them as part of a debate, a discussion, and I hope we can continue it today, that need to be overcome, that need to be made more nuanced for the international sphere. But then in the final part of my paper, I state, let's imagine what would a world look like without punishment, essentially, for international crimes. Can we conceive of post-conflict justice without punishment? And in my conclusion, I give two alternative visions of post-conflict justice, which completely excludes punishment from it. The first is the idea of criminal justice without punishment. So we continue the trials, we continue the performance of a criminal trial, the conviction, the judgment, but we simply remove the punitive aspect from it. And here, I can't show you the slide, unfortunately, but some scholars have argued that if we look at expressive character of the international criminal process, much of the expressive symbolism is done at the trial and conviction stage. Much of the aims that we wish to hope to achieve are, albeit in a limited sense, achieved already by the end of the conviction. And certainly if we complement a criminal justice without punishment process with other transitional justice, post-conflict justice processes, such as reparations, reconciliation, truth commissions, then perhaps we can find this as an acceptable alternative. The second alternative, and this is my final point, is in a paper by a fantastic scholar, Mahmoud Mamdani, who argues that in some circumstances, it would be better to dispense with criminal justice altogether in favor of political and, if possible, social justice. So for Mamdani, the criminal justice model is focused on two circumstances: there being a victor that can implement the justice, and there being, in the future, no need for the victims and perpetrators to live together in the same society. It's okay, it's fine. I don't need it. That's fine. He states that if we look at South Africa, both of those circumstances were not there. There was no victor in South Africa. There was a stalemate. And rather than the victims and the perpetrators moving into separate places in the world, the victims and perpetrators in South Africa had to live together going forward. In those circumstances, Mamdani argues that criminal justice is problematic. It demonizes the agency of the perpetrators who are put on trial. It freezes the identities of the victims and perpetrators when there has been a cycle of victimhood, whereby perpetrators and victims have often traded places throughout the ages. It ignores the political constituency which enabled the crimes to occur on each side, and it ignores the underlying structural issues that facilitated the crimes. Instead, Mamdani points to CODESA, the political program which brought about the new South African constitution, and states that this is a much better way forward in the absence of criminal justice than criminal justice could have achieved, because what it did was it brought both parties to the conflict together in an inclusive political community. Rather than demonizing, it included both sides to the conflict and set a platform for future stability. If complemented by a more robust truth and reconciliation program, which deals with the underlying structural issues of social justice, which didn't happen in South Africa, Mamdani argues that in those circumstances, that would be a preferable option. So the final point to make in my talk is there are fundamental moral challenges to justifying punishment for international crimes. And there are alternatives that are at least as convincing in certain circumstances that would enable us to imagine a world where impunity is not the greatest opponent of all. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.